In the early 90s, communication scholars began talking about the old concept of the newspaper. The, you know, those things on paper with ink.
Terry Mattingly speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The concept behind this, they called it the Daily We. That there was supposed to be a media product that we would consume that would help us learn about other people in our community, in our nation, and that we would at least be consuming some of the same information for the sake of debate, discourse, etc. The internet is absolutely brilliant at destroying the Daily We.
You can listen to Terry Mattingly's presentation, Making the Case for News Discernment, on an audio DVD of both of our 2017 Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300. Just click the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. We often talk about the sexual revolution, and I think most of the time we think about that in terms of a soft revolution, a pop revolution, a cultural revolution that takes place kind of the way the 60s waved over the United States. It was nonviolent. It was peace, love, and understanding. But the sexual revolution is not that anymore. It may have started out that way, well-meaning cultural revolutionaries who wanted us all to loosen up a little bit and not be so uptight about sexuality, not be so uptight about morality. It has moved far beyond that. I don't think anyone could argue that it's still in that stage. Has it reached that stage of revolution, like, say, the French Revolution, where it's beginning to dictate what is and isn't a crime? The Reign of Terror, it was called in the French Revolution. Joining us to talk about the sexual revolution's reign of terror, Dr. Stephen Baskerville, professor of government at Patrick Henry College. He is research fellow at the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, and he's author of the new book, The New Politics of Sex, and a recent column for Crisis Magazine titled The Sexual Revolution Turns Ugly. Dr. Baskerville, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
You liken what's happening in the sexual revolution of late to the Reign of Terror in the 1790s after the establishment of the first French Republic. Why do you make that comparison?
Well, there's a lot of comparisons between the current sexual revolution and the ideology of sexual radicalism, as I call it, and the ideologies behind revolutions like the French and the Bolshevik revolutions. In fact, you could make an argument that what we're seeing today, sexual radicalism, often accompanies political radicalism like the French and Russian revolutions. Other people have made that argument. But what we're seeing here today is, it's very similar to what the French fanatic of the French Revolution, Antoine de Saint-Just, said. He said, no freedom for the enemies of freedom, was his slogan. And this is kind of what we see today. In the sexual revolution, we see, first of all, demands for unlimited sexual freedom. This is the first phase of the revolution, where demands for unlimited, unrestrained sexual indulgence. And everyone, it sounded like a great thing for everybody, freedom and indulgence. But there's always an authoritarian side. There's always the violent side, the repression that comes after it. And that's what we're seeing here today with these accusations. First of all, there was the hedonistic culture of Hollywood and television and fashion industry, sexual freedom, indulgence, hedonism. But now we're seeing criminal accusations and threats of punishment, including prison. And this is what happens with many revolutions.
So this statement that we're hearing a lot in the last month or so, that there is a sexual harassment crisis or a sexual abusers crisis. What's wrong with that way of describing what's going on?
Well, it's an attempt to impose ideology on what previously had been simple sexual morality. In other words, a few years ago, we would have referred to these things as sexual immorality. We would have called them fornication or adultery. We would have called them sin. This was the kind of vocabulary we used. We've been taught to be ashamed of this vocabulary, which it's gone out the window. But instead, we were told they were going to remove all stigmas, and we were going to have, again, sexual freedom. But instead, what they've brought back is alternative stigmas, alternative taboos, alternative sins, although they often take the form of political crimes. So instead of referring to fornication or adultery, we now refer to sexual harassment or sexual assault and so forth. These are attempts to replace traditional morality with political ideology. And we now talk about misogyny and sexism and sexual harassment. And these terms have no definition. They don't mean anything. They're really just they're ideological constructions. But they are an attempt to impose criminality in the place of the old morality. The old morality was enforced by parents, by churches, by local communities, by social disapproval, by ostracism in the worst cases. But the new crimes, the new quasi-crimes, are enforced by the government. They're enforced by gendarmes, police, prosecutors, lawyers, and judges, and they have very serious penalties. So this is a very dangerous development, and we haven't had very little discussion about the consequences.
When you use that term political crimes, what are you saying there?
Well, take a term like sexual harassment. There's no definition. This is what many of these things have in common. Sexual harassment, sexual assault, domestic violence, many of these things. There's no child abuse is another one. They have no definition. They can be stretched to mean anything. The accusation can be stretched to fit the defendant rather than the other way around. So there's no clear. When we started out with sexual harassment, it referred to the power of superiors in the workplace to use leverage, their superior position, as leverage to extract sexual favors from underlings. But by the way, there were already rules against that, and there always have been. But when they imposed the term sexual harassment on this, they then expanded the term to mean any kind of interaction between men and women if someone files a complaint about it. So just an ordinary request for a date or request for a romantic relationship can be sexual harassment if someone objects. So it's become a way of poisoning, of criminalizing, of stigmatizing any relationships between the men and women, even if there's no power differential involved.
These are, by politicizing these activities, this misbehavior, we have taken it away from the rules and laws that ordinarily said a boss cannot coerce sexual favors from an employee, something like that, and said it's a different kind of a crime now for which, well, are there laws for these things? I mean, are there statutes written about the new political crimes that have been attached here?
Yes, there are, but they're often very vague. For example, sexual harassment, it started out as a civil matter. Supposedly, it was to be policed by employers. Employers were kind of cast in the role of the relationship police, at least in the workplace. So it was supposed to be entirely a civil matter that was enforced by the employers, and the employers could be held responsible civilly if this didn't happen. But if you look at the literature, that we crossed the line into quasi-criminal accusations very quickly. We hear terms like sexual harassment, then it becomes sexual abuse, then it becomes sexual assault. And it's not clear if we're talking about a civil matter or a criminal matter or a matter that really has no jurisdiction by the state at all. So it's very, very unclear. We find the feminists and the radicals trying to redefine even a matter as concrete, seemingly concrete, as rape. There are efforts underway to make rape a very vague matter. So even when there's consent, it can be called rape. And this is happening all the time. Domestic violence, one would think that's a very concrete matter. It's a matter of physical assault. No, but it's not. Domestic violence has nothing to do with physical assault, in fact. It can involve verbal insults. It can involve a refusal to give money. Anything can be domestic violence, even if there's no physical contact or any threat of it. So these terms conjure up images in our minds of horrible things, but the reality is oftentimes very nebulous and very unclear.
You point out that this is something that we had been warned was coming. What are you talking about there, Dr. Baskerville?
Well, Christians, for years, Christians were, gadflies were warning about the permissive sexual behavior. We had people like Mary Whitehouse in Britain, or Anthony Comstock here in the United States, or Yvonne de Gaulle in France, who warned against, sexual imagery on television and in the movies, who warned against increasingly sexualized clothing, sexualized entertainment. And they were laughed at. We ridiculed them. We made fun of them. We made people ashamed to use language like fornication or adultery. We made it impermissible to make comments if people were behaving improperly in the workplace or in church. We made it difficult for anyone to say anything. And now we're seeing the result of this. There's no stigma against you can't enforce sexual morality in interpersonal communication, face-to-face relationships. So instead, the gendarmes have stepped in and filled the vacuum. We get the police and the lawyers and the judges and the social workers. They're the ones that come in and start enforcing the new morality, the new criminality is really what it is. So people are terrified now to say anything. You know, for example, in the case of a divorce, it's very difficult to say anything that somebody's misbehaving. But the lawyers have no hesitancy in saying someone's misbehaving, and they put you in jail even when you're not misbehaving.
You kind of talk about the shock troops of the revolution, first the feminists, mm-hmm. then the homosexual ideologues. What role have they played?
Well, they're the ones that have primarily politicized this, and they did it basically in two phases. First of all, they encouraged the sexual permissiveness, and they still encourage it. They encourage unlimited sexual freedom, sexual indulgence, without any restraint, without any limits, without any stigma. But then on the other hand, they come along and they start launching civil and quasi-criminal and fully criminal accusations against people who oftentimes don't realize they'd committed a crime, or in many cases didn't commit a crime, and who can't defend themselves. The unlimited sex in the evening becomes an accusation of rape in the morning. The demand for unlimited divorce on demand becomes a demand to incarcerate men who can't pay child support, so-called. The integration of the workplace, the integration of the military, becomes accusations of sexual abuse there. So there's always this kind of two-stage phase which the ideologues, the feminist and homosexualist ideologues, have perpetrated. On the one hand, freedom. On the other hand, repression.
We're talking about the sexual revolution's reign of terror with Dr. Stephen Baskerville of Patrick Henry College. When we come back, the danger of confusing bad behavior with crimes.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
How do we continue faithfully to confess and practice our Lutheran faith in a culture of secularism, pluralism, and relativism? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is the 2017 edition of Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Luther's Small Catechism with Explanation, 2017 edition.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues Etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Monday afternoon, we're talking about the sexual revolution's reign of terror. Dr. Stephen Baskerville is our guest, author of the new book, The New Politics of Sex, and a recent column for Crisis Magazine titled The Sexual Revolution Turns Ugly. You're pretty tough in your article on National Review for coming late to the game and kind of playing into the hands of a lot of this redefinition of terms, but they do have a column out today warning us not to draw an equivalence between bad behavior on the part of these public figures and genuine crimes. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Baskerville?
That's correct, and that's intentional. I mean, this has been the modus operandi from the beginning, is to blur this distinction between precisely that, just unpleasant behavior, personal disagreement, you know, personal friction, that sort of thing, on the one hand, which is not criminal and does not fall under the jurisdiction of the state, and on the other hand, clearly criminal behavior like rape or assault. Domestic violence is perhaps the best example of this, and one that National Review and others refuse to touch. But it's probably one of the most serious ones, where domestic violence can be, insulting your spouse verbally. It can, if your spouse demands money and you refuse to give it, that's domestic violence, or economic violence, verbal violence. These terms don't mean psychological violence. So these terms don't mean anything. But domestic violence has nothing to do with physical assault. It's a term that is used, well, it's used for several purposes. It's used to get children away from fathers in divorce proceedings. It's also been used for jumping to the head of the queue in immigration restrictions, to get around immigration restrictions. There's an international convention now on domestic violence, which some people say is being used to blur the distinction between the sexes, between the so-called genders. So these kind of things, yes, this nebulousness, this blurring the distinction between criminal and non-criminal behavior has been part of this from the very start.
So in that sense, people who don't want to see this distinction blurred, you know, we tend to kind of cluck our tongues when we see someone like Senator Al Franken hoisted on his own petard, but the basis upon which he's being hoisted may in fact be, although he's admitted to be guilty of the things that were photographed, it may be the very thing that's undoing the social fabric with respect to the sexual revolution.
Yes, very much so. Yes, and it is a shame to see conservatives jumping on board on this. They're very tempted when they see someone like Bill Clinton or Edward Kennedy or Al Franken or Weinstein. They want to use the language, but what they do when they accuse them, when they invoke the feminist, the ideological language like sexual harassment and misogyny and these sort of terms, they're further displacing what had been traditional morality with political ideology. So I think they're really playing into the hands of the left-wing ideologues here.
You have written about this in your latest book, the creation of what you call a new political ideology, sometimes you even say political theology, which has as its mechanism the control of sexuality. Talk about that.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it is no accident that these accusations, these various kinds of gender crimes, as I call them, these coincide with, you know, demands for things like same-sex marriage, increased liberalization of the abortion, and expansion of the welfare state. These are all different manifestations of the sexual revolution, but they're all connected. One of the manifestations that's not treated at all, again, is the attack on fathers in the divorce courts. But these are all part of the same, they're all pushed by the same people. It's all the feminist lobby, more recently piggybacking by the homosexualist lobby. It's all part of the same radical agenda.
What is the end game? Can we perceive what the goal of this might be?
The goal is like all ideologies, it's power. It's power, and that's what all political ideologies want. That's the bottom line. If you look at the feminist and homosexualist literature, they're very forthright about this. The word empowerment is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. They may not be conscious that they are craving power, but that's very much what it is, and that's very much what it does. It shifts power to government officials, to functionaries, to lawyers, to judges, to ideologues. And that's the bottom. And this is interestingly why, for example, you can see a kind of tacit collusion or alliance sometimes even between groups like feminists and homosexualists on the one hand, and Islamists on the other hand. Conservatives are very puzzled by the fact that feminists and seldom criticize Islamists. And homosexualist groups also seldom criticize Islamists. But the bottom line, again, is power. They can make alliances like that because the common enemy in both cases is traditional Christian morality, which alone limits the power of the state.
Is the goal to, and I think I've discussed this with other guests, in some sense, to politicize all human relationships?
I think that is the effect. Whether that's, I don't know that that's the conscious effect. Probably not. In most cases, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy to do this, but this is the effect. All ideologies do this, whether it's socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, Islamism. They all increase the power of the state. They all have a tendency to politicize private life, to deny the legitimacy of any private sphere of life, and to give the state a rationalization to interfere in the most personal corners of our lives. And this ideology, which politicizes sexual relations and family relations above all, is the logical conclusion of this trend. If you look at the way children have become politicized, the way, you know, child abuse accusations are another example of this. There's no definition of child abuse. Parents accused of child abuse don't get trial. They don't get formally charged with a crime. They don't get any chance to clear their name. They just have their children taken away. Again, it blurs the distinction between, you know, parental discipline and criminality.
We've spoken before about the family courts and how these proceedings sometimes are very perfunctory, and especially in the case of divorce or child custody. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, very much so. One of the common features of all of these manifestations of sexual radicalism is the creation of these kind of very kinds of kangaroo courts. The family courts are a good example of that. They do not observe due process of law. More recently, they've created what they call domestic violence courts, whose clear purpose, whose openly stated purpose, is to convict more men and punish more men for so-called domestic violence. You can see this on the university campuses, these so-called campus tribunals that purport to try university male students for rape and sexual assault. They're not real courts at all. They're composed of faculty members and administrators and students. So these quasi-judicial procedures, which don't recognize the standard due process protections and constitutional protections of real courts, are a common feature of this, much like the phony tribunals of the French Revolution or the Nazis.
Let's move to the college campus, where there have been a number of what you call rape hoaxes. Give us some examples, and how did those events transpire?
Well, there's been a number of these. Fortunately, this is an area that has received quite a lot of attention recently from some good scholars and some good journalists. But there was the famous rape hoax at the University of Virginia, where there have been a number of these, the mattress girl at Columbia, virtually all of them, the so-called epidemic of campus rape. Virtually all of these cases have turned out to be a hoax, and a number of scholars like Heather McDonald and a few others have stated quite clearly and shown evidence that there is no epidemic of rape on campus. There's an epidemic of accusations of rape on campus. These hoaxes are, they're very similar to what I call the hoax of, for example, the deadbeat dad. I've shown repeatedly, and others have as well, that the so-called deadbeat dads, which were being attacked mercilessly in the 90s and ever since, is a hoax. It's a creation of government policy. There's no evidence that there's large numbers of men deserting their families and refusing to pay child support. What you do have is an epidemic of judges throwing men out of their families and plundering their salaries and plundering their savings and calling them deadbeat dads. So again, the modus operandi is very similar in these different cases.
Do we find this working its way into the U.S. military in any way?
Yes, we do. There's a good study by that I rely on in my book, Brian Mitchell's book on that, and Martin Van Creveld, and some of the work at the Center for Military Readiness have all shown that there have been a number of these witch hunts, fake accusations of sexual violence against military men, the most famous being the Navy's tailhook scandal and one in the Air Force Academy. Again, these were orgies, basically. They were, you know, instances of sexual debauchery by men and women after the integration of the military. and they turned into criminal accusations against the men. Again, with courts martial rather than standard courts, where trumped up accusations, where the procedures were essentially rigged in advance. So yes, just another example of the same pattern.
Dr. Stephen Baskerville of Patrick Henry College is our guest. We're talking about the sexual revolution's reign of terror. We'll be right back. Talk about what we should do about the genuinely criminal cases and the cases of bad behavior. Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Pastors are the ones who are getting in the way of what the Spirit wants to do.
Pastor Chris Roseborough speaking at this year's Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The Spirit really wants to take the church and supercharge it and cause this worldwide global renewal to occur and for billions of souls to be harvested for Jesus. But you're a pastor. Your pastor wears clerical collars. You sing hymns. You're out of date. You're in the way of the Spirit. So give way. Get those old wineskins out, and it's time for the new wineskins to come in.
You can listen to Pastor Roseborough's teaching, Making the Case Against Modern-Day Prophets and Apostles, on an audio DVD from the 2017 Making the Case Conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end donation of $300. IssuesETC.org. Click the audio DVD. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilk. We're talking about the sexual revolution's reign of terror with Dr. Stephen Baskerville, professor of government at Patrick Henry College, research fellow at the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, author of the new book, The New Politics of Sex, and a recent column for Crisis Magazine titled, The Sexual Revolution Turns Ugly. Dr. Baskerville, someone will inevitably ask, what should we do then in terms of just how should society respond and deal with the cases that are genuinely criminal and the cases of mere bad behavior?
Right. A good question. As far as one most basic thing to do is observe the Constitution, observe due process of law. I mean, this would take care of a lot of these accusations. Traditionally, we draw a line between criminality and non-criminality. We insist that the criminal law should be precise, should be concrete, should be clear why a jury is being asked to put a man in prison. What exactly are they being asked to do? Not nebulous things like child abuse or domestic violence or sexual harassment. So we observe the Constitution, the standard due process protections of the Constitution and the English common law. The other thing we should be doing, journalists and scholars should be investigating this. They should be doing it critically. They should be investigating when this is not happening. We need to, in some cases, we need to make clear criminal accusations. Parents accused of child abuse or men accused of domestic violence should be charged, formally charged with a crime. They should be tried by a jury of their peers. If they are convicted, they should be imprisoned. And if they're acquitted, they should be left in peace. And that's the way most people assume the law operates, and it's the way the law should operate.
But in fact, it doesn't.
In fact, it doesn't. Yes, we have lost the media hysteria, the sexualization of our political culture. We have lost this ability to understand what constitutes due process of law and how the Constitution works. And that's a big part of what we need to recover. It's not that hard to do. I mean, the measures that are on the books. The laws are on the books. The constitutional protections are there. We just we're just not observing them. And we're not the journalists and the scholars are not, and the other gadflies, the church, is another silent voice that's not speaking out. And that's another thing we need to do. For the criminal matters, then yes, we need to prosecute criminally with juries, with due process protections, but criminal procedures. And for those instances that are not criminal, the church needs to speak out. The church needs to show. The church, why isn't the church, with all these accusations of sexual impropriety, why aren't the churches standing on the rooftops shouting, at the top of their lungs, the biblical morality has been vindicated? I mean, all of this shows that if we'd stuck with the Christian morality a few years ago, we might have saved all of this problem. Instead, the Christian leaders are hiding under the table. They don't want to get involved in this. They're terrified of being accused of apologizing for rape or sexual harassment or domestic violence. They should be claiming vindication, because what all of this shows is what happens when we renounce, when we abandon the traditional morality. The lawyers and the gendarmes fill the vacuum.
Do we need to regain the church's old vocabulary on these things, like fornication, adultery, even something as simple as sin?
Absolutely. We don't even hear these things. I don't even hear these things in sermons anymore. If I hear a sermon on divorce, it's usually very weak. I never hear a sermon on cohabitation or out of wedlock births. And yet, these are precisely the areas where private immorality is having a huge impact on public policy. I mean, if you look at the way that out-of-wedlock birth, cohabitation, illegitimacy, if you'll forgive the term, the huge numbers of fatherless children, these are the major cause of social ills, they're the major cause of violent crime, of substance abuse, they're the major cause of domestic spending, is these problems. So this failure of the churches to speak in the matter of private sexual morality is having repercussions throughout our society, both in terms of social pathologies and in terms of government spending to control these social pathologies. I can't think of any area where the work of the church is more directly related to that of secular society, and yet again, the churches are silent.
I want you to go into a little more detail of how, as you say, the radicals, either by accident or design, have adroitly recruited conservative moralizers as their stooges.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Again, I think it's the conservatives have become weak at the knees. The Christians, leaders to some extent, and conservatives have adopted the method, the language, the vocabulary, the jargon, and the methods of their opponents. As Kathy Young wrote in a column once, conservatives suddenly got recruited to the concept of sexual harassment when in their eagerness to get Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton committed adultery. He hit on a married woman, as I understand it, and he betrayed his own wife. Harvey Weinstein did something similar. Why can't we just call this immoral adultery? Why can't we call this fornication? Why do we have to invoke these nebulous ideological terms like misogyny or sexism or sexual harassment? We have plain words that mean we can use plain English. Instead, we've adopted this ideological jargon, and conservatives have done the same thing, and I think they're paying for it.
Why has that happened? What was the path to shaming religious conservatives into adopting the language of the sexual revolution, its new terms?
Well, it's a good question. I think it came out of the new left and the language of the 1960s and 70s. We laughed at people like Mary Whitehouse and Anthony Comstock and Yvonne de Gaulle. And we made it, we stopped talking about sin. Sin made it sound like stealing cookies out of the jar. So instead, it was much nicer to talk about crime. Crime made it sound really serious. But by doing that, we kind of shifted this jurisdiction from the churches and the families and the local communities and the citizens to the professionals, the gendarmes and the lawyers and the judges. So we turned sin into crime. I guess we wanted to make it sound more serious and more effective. But I think we're paying for that now.
For decades, we have been told that if we were to, for a moment, allow any talk of morality, much less biblical morality, to govern our thoughts, that we're going to end up with witch hunts. But it sounds like we've ended up with worse witch hunts than ever existed under a Christian morality.
It's very true. You're very right about that. I think that is the case. I don't think anyone planned it that way. But we find this oftentimes with revolutions and with radical movements. They create the very problems they claim to be solving. Oftentimes they create much worse problems than those they claim to be solving. They become incarnations of what they were doing battle against, and they become more vicious versions of the same thing. We saw this with Stalin. Stalin inherited the repressive apparatus of Tsarist nationalism, and he made it many, many times worse. And this is kind of what we're seeing now, is the Stalinization of the sexual revolution.
Someone is going to criticize your comparison to the French Reign of Terror by saying, look, the Reign of Terror was typified by these mass executions, thousands of executions, the guillotine and bloodletting, and we're not going to come to that. What are your thoughts there, Dr. Baskerville?
In terms of the bloodletting, I don't think we've quite come to that yet. In terms of the incarceration, I think we have come to that very closely. You know, look at the situation in which fathers in divorce courts are incarcerated without any trial, without due process protections. In many cases, as I show in the book, there's not even any record of the incarcerations. In other words, fathers are summarily incarcerated in divorce courts, and there's not even a record that they are incarcerated. And I didn't come up with this. This is two researchers who found this in several different states. We do know that the prison population is exploding. In Maria Gottschalk's book, The Prison and the Gallows, she shows that much of behind this is the feminist campaigns against domestic violence and rape has had a huge role in the explosion of the prison population in this country. So in terms of creating a gulag, like we saw in the Soviet and Maoist movements, we are already there. If you look at the main cause of incarceration, fatherlessness is the main cause of criminality. The common feature, ask any policeman, they will tell you the main predictor of criminality in adolescence is not having a father. It's more important than race. It's more important than poverty. So we are already filling up the jails right now as a result of the sexual revolution.
What would you say to someone who says, look, oh, up until now, they were giving Bill Clinton a pass on this, and now no one's getting a pass. Everyone's being called to account, both conservatives and political liberals. Maybe the media and our culture is finally coming around and coming to its senses on these matters of sexuality. How would you respond to that?
Well, it's not a very attractive and certainly not a very effective way of dealing with sexual immorality. It's really got all of the features of mob justice. On the one hand, we're frightened to enforce sexual morality in our private lives. It's very hard to say anything in private conversation about someone who's, you know, dresses provocatively or goes through initiates a divorce or makes false accusations of some kind of crime. On the other hand, we're perfectly willing to, you know, use the courts and the public system of criminal justice to punish people. It just shows a certain moral debasement in our society and a certain cowardice in our society when we are willing to use professional accusers and professional disapprovers to enforce our morality for us, rather than doing it in our private lives. There's a huge increase in the power of the state. And once you use this, it can be used against anybody. I'm not going to apologize for Harvey Weinstein or Bill Clinton or anybody else, but they're only the top of the radar screen. For every one of them, beneath the radar screen, these same methods can be used against the innocent. And there's no defense and there's no media attention to this. So we need to be careful. These accusations are like germ warfare. Once you release them on people, you can't control them.
Finally, then, what specifically can be done to thwart the new politics of sex?
I think a huge role falls with journalists like you. I'm glad that you're, you know, doing a show like this. I think that, you know, the sunlight of publicity would be a huge role. I think the gadflies of our society, those who are supposed to be the traditional watchdogs of government power, need to speak out. By those, I mean the journalists. I mean those, my fellow scholars in the academic world. I mean the church. These are the people we think of as the traditional, those who check government power, those who tell the government when they're misbehaving, those who inform the rest of us when the government is misbehaving, and they're the ones that aren't doing their job. They're instead of watchdogs, they're being lapdogs. Many of them are government-funded themselves, so they have no incentive to control the power of the state. Instead, they become cheerleaders for the power of the state. So we need to demand that the churches, the journalists, the scholars in the universities start to do their job, and if they don't do it, we need to do it for them, and to use the internet and the social media to act as our own journalists, our own scholars, and our own priests.
Dr. Stephen Baskerville is professor of government at Patrick Henry College. He's research fellow at the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, and he's author of the new book, The New Politics of Sex, and a recent column for Crisis Magazine titled The Sexual Revolution Turns Ugly. You can read it, and you can purchase The New Politics of Sex at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Baskerville, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
If you enjoy conversations on the topic of Christianity and culture, be sure to order an audio DVD of our two Making the Case conferences in 2017. It covers issues like the Benedict Option, Christians engaging the news media, Christian marriage, natural law, news discernment, and the sexual revolution. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300 to Issues, etc. Order by check, make your check payable to Issues, etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Be sure to write audio DVD in the memo line of your check. You can also order online at issuesetc.org. It's an audio DVD of this year's summer and fall Making the Case conferences. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Esther in the Old Testament, and it's our weekly media coverage of religion feature with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
This holiday shopping season, skip the Fruit of the Month Club. Don't fall for any ridiculous as-seen-on-TV offers. Just say no to ugly sweaters. Instead, give your family and friends the best of Lutheran reflection on faith and life, theology and culture, delivered monthly right to their mailboxes. Give them the Lutheran Witness magazine. Visit cph.org/witness to purchase subscriptions for Christmas or anytime. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
The substitute organist service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the substitute organist service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the substitute organist service at churchmusicsolutions.com. churchmusicsolutions.com.